I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
That's right, Parallax Views is back, and we're starting the new year, the new decade, I should say, with a conversation featuring friend of the show, C. Derek Varn, on his new and improved podcast series, Pop the Left, for Zero Books, as well as getting his take on the situation with Iran, in light of the assassination of General Soleimani. Now, I have to note this was recorded the day after said assassination, and tensions have only continued to rise since then. Folks, in a word, it is escalating in a way that has actually even surprised your host. Nonetheless, I feel that Derek's insights remain relevant. And of course, Derek and I go off into a number of different tangents, covering some odds and ends throughout the conversation. And with that being said, why don't we dive right in with C. Derek Varn of Zero Books, new and improved, Pop the Left Podcast. Welcome back to Parallax Views. C. Derek Varn of Zero Books and the new and improved Pop the Left Podcast.
Hi.
So, in terms of pleasantries, how have you been the past few weeks? Were the holidays okay? How are things going for C. Derek Varn?
The holidays were fine. I've gotten resettled and started, you know, my recordings, had a break from teaching, and the world moves on as it does. And, you know, we began the holidays with Corbyn losing, and we will end the holidays with an escalation of hostilities with Iran. But things move along as they do.
And maybe for my listeners that are unfamiliar, maybe you could just give a brief outline of your new podcast. Well, I should say a new iteration of your Pop the Left podcast.
Yeah, so Pop the Left was a podcast that Douglas Lane and I did back in the Diet Soap era before either one of us worked for Zero Books. It was done with first three people, then one person kind of left and ended up becoming a right-wing pundit later on. We did it for about a year and a half, and we got into a fight that was superficially about Hegel, probably more about our egos, and quit doing it. And it was kind of influential in a bunch of small group of people at the time, because there weren't a lot of left-wing podcasts, and there definitely weren't a lot of critical left-wing podcasts.
Wasn't it mainly focused on critiquing, like, the sort of, like, late 90s, early 2000s sort of, what was it, like, post-left anarchism?
Yeah, about half of it was critiquing post-left anarchism. The other half was, like, critiquing really, really vulgar forms of Marxism that were emerging out of Occupy. Some of it was about critiquing the relationship to the Democrats after Occupy. You know, and I was actually talking recently about one of the things about all those shows is that they were, like, the historical ones have aged well, but the specific ones where we were actually going after tendencies or whatever tend to not age very well because those tendencies were already becoming irrelevant by the time we were critiquing them. Like, we did an episode on Chomsky, and we did an episode on Zarzan, and then we interviewed Zarzan, and we did an episode on Zizek. And those episodes are, I mean, they're fine for what they are, but they feel like a time capsule. After doing Systematic Redness, which was my other podcast for a while, which I felt was becoming more part of the left-wing media circuit, like it was just, it's becoming very stale, and I found myself talking more and more about arts and literature than anything theoretical or political, because I just wanted to do something different. And we killed that. This last episode, it's been, you know, our last, its last recorded episode has been broken up into four parts, but it should be aired. By the second week of the new year, it'll be gone. And we'll be releasing Pop the Left. And Pop the Left, then its second iteration, has been much more what I like to call historical critical, which means, like, we take a concept, we look at its historical development and practice, we go through some key text, and then, you know, I contextualize those texts. I don't just do the theory bro explanation. There's a lot of history work that I'm doing right now. And then we try to apply that now. And when we apply it, it's not so much to say, oh, in the past that we did this, so we should do this again. It is, oh, this question seems to still be unanswered. Why is it unanswered? How does it affect things now? What are we ignoring? And that is the kind of critical approach that I take to it. It is not so much trying to provide people with answers, but trying to get people to ask much better questions that kind of pop their standard framework for how they deal with the left. It isn't to try to get rid of it or take it away or to say that they're all wrong, but to have people have some epistemic humility in their theory and some tactics and caution in their praxis, and not to fall into just habits of mind or habits of, you know, of organizing that we've just done because we do them, you know. And I sometimes feel like a lot of what left-wingers do, certain kinds of protest, certain kinds of tactics, certain kinds of party building, these are more just habits of an age that we don't live in.
Well, I think the other thing that you've said, not to cut you off, but the other thing that I think you've said that's very prescient is that a lot of times it seems like we as leftists have a tendency to project our own hopes onto, I forget the wording you use, but we sort of project our hopes onto politics in a way that may not always be pragmatic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, how are leftists so wrong about elections over and over again? Liberals are too, frankly, but leftists particularly are, and they've gotten worse. They were actually better in the time period where they just assumed we were going to lose all the time, but they were ignoring obvious trends. So
I was going to say real quick, I was surprised that there were at least some people on social media saying they were completely taken off guard by Corbyn's loss.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. I mean,
I was surprised at how bad it was.
I was surprised at how bad it was too. But I wanted Corbyn to win, but I'm also not – I don't know. Some people would say I'm pessimistic, but I try to, like, not go, you know, full everything is roses and we're in the clear. And I also don't think that social media is necessarily an indicator of the public will.
Well, social media tends young, tends educated. I mean, Facebook doesn't, but also a lot of what's on Facebook that doesn't tend young and educated isn't political, but Twitter definitely does. To go even further than that, I mean, there were a lot of just outright denials about what was going on in the Corbyn campaign. Corbyn's stance towards Brexit was always kind of lingering and would draw things out. And even many remainders have come to the point in polls where they would just like this to be over and settled.
Well, traditionally, Corbyn was a Eurosceptic, and probably rightfully so.
Right, he was, but he also, like, to keep his coalition together, he had to talk about, he had to keep remainders and Lexiters, which is left Brexit, together, right? And also, neither party really had a good, I mean, like, when I say this, like, Lexit always kind of is predicated on this ability to print enough currency to transform the English economy back into a production economy and not a financial economy, which is what it is right now, which was always sort of not very much of a great idea because a lot of the MMT theories is based off on come from the imperial period, where, you know, you could just force people to buy stuff at currency. So that could create real wealth by basically force fiat. But that's not the case anymore. And I'm not sure that I'm sold that Britain, even as, you know, as a modern economy, could support its own production enough to generate a generous welfare state. Just not – I don't know that I believe that. And I don't think a lot of voting populace totally believe that either. And then there was the other elephant in the room is Labour, despite all its working class aesthetics and Corbyn's appeal to that, had actually had less working class constituency in its voters than it traditionally had. And that's been polling – Since the end of Tony Blair's period, and this has gotten worse and worse. Now, is there a lot of working class people who support it? Yes, if they're young and in cities. But the trends of the British electorate look a lot more like the American one than the traditional Labour-Tory divide.
What would you say that trajectory is? I mean, where do you see the sort of demographics being at in terms of age, race, class, and all these issues?
I am guessing, but I'm not an expert on the UK's electoral patterns, but I am guessing that you saw a lot of people, a lot of immigrants sit on their hands, that London was largely Labour, that Labour probably would have done better if it had a proportional you know, not first past the post electoral system, but it still would have lost probably, just not as badly. That the Brexit party scared some people back into the Tories. And that basically the less London and less urban regions had a stronger showing for the Tories, even amongst constituencies which were normally dependent on Labour, partly because, I mean, in those areas, people are aging out of unions and the new work has been largely neoliberalized, and partly because a lot of people don't seem to think that Corbyn could have delivered on his promise. And if you look at what he had to do to maintain his coalition, were they wrong? Because he had to hold two completely opposing factions together within the Labour Party. You know, so he had to speak out of both ends of his mouth.
Now, do you think this will play into the situation in the U.S. with all the hopes being pinned on Bernie Sanders right now by the left?
Yeah, I do, actually. I do think Bernie stands to do better against Trump than Biden does, and I don't think that hope is completely false. I know a lot of people who would support Bernie Sanders over Trump, even if they were conservative. But I also agree with you that I think that whole conservative for Bernie movement is thinner than people realize. It's like liberals for Ron Paul.
Well, the thing is, I could see a lot of like establishment sort of beltway types voting for Trump over Bernie.
I can too, for sure. And then I can also see a bunch of, I mean, he's a Jewish socialist atheist. Is he like, you don't have easier targets in American life than that. You know, I mean, I guess he could be a black woman Jewish socialist atheist, but who's also an immigrant. No, they can't be an immigrant because the president has to be native born. So like, so, you know, but in all seriousness, and he's old and white. So there's also a constituency that could, there's also an internal to the Democrat constituency that could go against him, even if he has popular support amongst people of color, which right now he does, at least in the major liberal states. Although the major liberal states also matter a lot less than people want to believe, because their, you know, their electoral weight is not equal to small rural states, and complaining about that is not fixing it.
Where is the public political will right now? Or is there a public
I suspect that there, one, this is an anti-political mood we've been in for a while. That's how we got Trump. Two, Trump is much more establishment than people thought. I mean, let's be honest. He's gauche, but – and he until recently didn't seem to be as cavalier with war, although that seems to have ended like, I don't know, yesterday. But – He has ended up being much more of the status quo for Republicans than people realize. And so he's not a break from the status quo. The economy's not bad. I mean, yes, there's all kinds of signs that it's getting fragiler, but we don't know that that'll break immediately, and it probably won't. Now, yes, there's been things that could make it worse, but all the talk of the tariffs and causing this impending economic doom hasn't played out. Now, the tariffs had caused inflation in the United States, which, but that's been a slow burn. So what do you do? Well, it just seems to me that if you look at every historical indicator, except that Trump is immensely unpopular, odds are actually in his favor, despite polling indicating the opposite. Trump has many highly unfavorability and more people opposing him. But if we're looking at it clearly, you don't see a lot of reason for the working class to come out, even for Bernie. And if that's the case, and the economy is good, and there's no super disastrous war, and the Senate can throw out the impeachment proceedings, basically. He's likely to win. And while the impeachment is popular, people forget that, you know, our only example of a sitting impeached president in modern times is Clinton, but it actually helped his reputation.
Well, real briefly, if we can back up, you said that the working class wouldn't necessarily be motivated to go out and vote for a Bernie Sanders. Because, why do you say that?
Because the working class isn't stupid. All right. And I'm going to say something that'll make people uncomfortable. Bernie is in a better state to implement many of his socialist parties in the Senate than he is as a president. Now, in Marxism,
it's funny because I believe Mike Gravel has said something similar about, like, you can't just have a president. You sort of need a Congress with progressive candidates as well.
Right. And like, yeah, you have the squad in the House of Representatives. That's four of how many people? Representing areas that are either very, very safe for Democrats because of ethnic divisions and immigrants, are very, very safe because they're just historically Democratic. But that's the squad. The squad is four freshman Congress people. And yes, they have a lot of clout. But I'm already seeing people talking about AOC running with Bernie as vice president, which is ludicrous. Yes, you know, it's the long fresh blood, and yes, Trump proves that anyone can do it, but and AOC is broadly speaking popular amongst the progressive base, but that would be the most easily demonized ticket I can think of. And there's no one AOC brings that Bernie doesn't already have. So in some ways, this is confusing. This is just projecting our hopes about a left-wing electorate onto American politics without realizing the country that we live in is the same country.
Do you think the country is anti-left-wing?
No, I don't.
Just more anti-political.
I think it's more anti-political. I think anti-political feelings cut right wing mostly because it favors – it tends to favor doing nothing. But I don't think it's because people don't want – I think all the policies Bernie would offer would actually be broadly speaking popular. But people also have said that for 30 years. You know, that was true when Dennis Kucinich was running too. Didn't change anything. Why? Because the makeup of the House and Senate, even if the Democrats take the Senate, will not be so strongly blue because nobody has still built up a grassroots electoral movement to back this up. The DSA is petering out. It's at a year. It's had very little. It seems to have slowed its growth to about 40,000 to 60,000, which is what the SDS had. That yes, that's the largest group the left has seen since the Students for a Democratic Society, which was not an explicitly socialist group. But it's still smaller if you actually adjust for population size, because I'm talking in real numbers, and it's, you know, not even a borough in New York. You know what I mean? Like, it's not really that big. It's not even a caucus. There are cults with more members.
Well, it's interesting, too, because, I mean, when we talk about the sort of public will or the political will of the people, I think people confuse their ability to express themselves politically and sort of throw out their anger or discontent on social media or their ability to protest with having the will to change things.
Yeah, you know, I always like to talk about the history of what protest used to mean before we got all this Martin Luther King nonsense in our head. All right. You know why you protested? Because before modern munitions, if you could hold a protest, you could also, you had organized people enough that all you had to do was give them swords or rifles and you had an army. It was an implicit threat of force. Kind of like a riot is now, but a riot's not organized. So they burn out pretty quickly and largely they're largely containable. Now, I'm not saying that protesting was all based on violence, but even in the Martin Luther King civil rights movement, there's two things you have to remember. Not only was there like the Nation of Islam and even some of the more militant rings of the people aligned with Martin Luther King, who didn't want violence but thought, you know, if it was necessary, they'd go there. But there's also the Soviet Union. As an international power to which we did not want to completely look like we lived up to every one of their demonizations of us for.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just going to add to that. It's interesting because I think the civil rights movement's successes in the 60s were almost indirectly in part due to the Soviet Union.
Right.
In the sense that, like you said, we didn't want to live up to those demonizations. So the powers that be in this country sort of, they gave a little bit more than they usually do.
It is no surprise that the New Deal emerged out of, you know, not just some of the what is technically, people would throw around the word neoliberal for this, but they'd be wrong. It's technically ordo-liberal economic policies, which is truly free market. But also because it was a time period where there was actually a socialist movement in America. Right? That, in a weird way, sapped all that. Even Chapo Trap House knows that. Okay? One of the greatest periods of progressive capitalism in American history was actually partly to suppress communism within the United States. Even though towards the end of that period, because of the Popular Front and the war, the SPUSA ended up supporting the Democrats too and has effectively done that since then on the Popular Front period. But in a weird way, it was also like that support from communists and even some of those communist sympathies was also a way to weaken them. And it was purely tactical. So, you know, and I'm not saying FDR didn't want to help the American working class. I'm actually sure he probably did and was a small time class trader in that way. But he did not want a socialist revolution for sure.
Well, he reminds me a bit of, I mean, I think you know by now that I have a soft spot for Gore Vidal. And
right.
Vidal, actually, he talked a little bit like FDR in so much as, you know, he was from an elite family, but he thought that, you know, more should be done for the working class and the middle class. But he wasn't like a socialist. People always say that he was like
the
Superman of the left. He called himself old right, you know.
Right. Which I in a way, it leads to some of his more problematic stuff at the end of his life where he was, you know, waxing poetic about Timothy McVeigh, right? But you're right. He was. And, I mean, it's one of these things right now, like, for example, I find the American conservative is kind of incoherent when Trump's in power. It can't really figure out what it wants to do. Except on war, right? Like, they're good. Like, if you want to read their reporting on war, they're actually pretty good, and they're better than a lot of liberal sources. But where does that lead us, you know, in regards to Bernie Sanders? I think we don't really know. I think right now we everybody tends to act like there's a large working class movement or a large movement of people of color, but and yes, there are more and more people in sub-demographics voting, but it's not enough to throw the elections, except in opposition. But the opposition fades out. I mean, the other thing that people forgot, you know, they were talking about this whole, you know, blue wave or pink tide or whatever in the Senate, but the thing you have to always remember is that just follows the same historical pattern that put the Tea Party in power. Did the Tea Party matter within 4 years? Not at all. And no, Trump is not a manifestation of the Tea Party. Like, and I'm not saying that the DSA is going to go that way, but it people don't learn from American history, and they definitely don't learn from world history.
You know, it's interesting too, because I feel like a lot of political discussions, even the more you know, quote unquote fringe ones, I was just reading an article, I think it was from the Chronicle of Higher Education. A few people were sharing it about the rise of the Catholic non-liberal movement, and I'm like, this is very much really confined to sort of an intelligentsia that has the time to, you know, think about and postulate ideas about Catholicism and non-liberalism, like Patrick
right.
Deneen. This doesn't apply to like the everyday person, and I think that's true on both left and right. I think a lot of people mistake the intelligentsia for the sort of the public at large.
I think the intelligentsia matters. I don't want to say it doesn't, but I also if this new Catholic anti-liberal post-rightist movement emerges, you know, from Deneen and what's the other, the V name, Vermiculo. I read the article, although some of them are – Deneen's not, but some of them are fascist, frankly. And I don't – for people who know me, I don't actually throw that word around much. But what they will do would have more effect in 30 years, you know? It's not the currency yet. Now, I know things seem accelerated from social media because we all get to talk about everything and everybody's on it. But in reality, the pace of political change is we tend to confuse the spectacle about it changing with it actually changing.
Well, it's like I said, I feel like today we have more. Let me put it this way. So I think in the past, we didn't have as much access as we do today to go on Twitter and say to David Frum or David Brooks or Max Boot, fuck you, you're wrong. And I think that pisses off, you know, the commentariat and whatnot. But we can't confuse that ability to freely express ourselves with actual power.
Right. Agreed. Agreed, like, 100%. Power is still power. And we also can't assume that because people are silent, they're consenting to our agenda. You know, or to anyone's agenda. And we often do. We assume, for example, that educated people of color speak for all people of color. We assume that all the time, which is in and of itself a little racist and definitely classist. I don't like using that term. I prefer to think of class warfare, but I actually think they're somewhat different. And this is just like underestimating people from other classes.
I mean, this goes back to what we were saying about, I mean, the reason I initially mentioned Vidal in relation to FDR is that, like, even within that sort of elite sector of society, there's internecine sort of strife. And it happens with race, it happens with gender. There's always internecine sort of strife going on. We can't act as if everyone's in total agreement with everything.
Right. Well, this is interesting, right? We live in the moment of quote-unquote intersectional, you know, identity politics. But people are awfully bad at actually looking at the intersections. Like, really terrible at it, actually. You know, I told someone once that all the sociology backs up that as a person of color moves up the class scale, that race becomes more important to them because it's actually the bigger factor in their inability to succeed. Right? Whereas if you talk to, like, working class people of color, yeah, they think racism's a problem, too. It's a big problem. But it's not the problem in the same way it's going to be for an academic or an activist or someone with a lot of social capital. And they are still, despite the fact that they are, you know, like black women are literally the fastest growing, you know, per capita college graduates. That's true. But historically speaking, it's still a very small part of the entire apparatus. And there's some other things to consider. For example, usually students of color at, and particularly black and Latino students, at a elite institution actually come from a social class higher than the white students there, which interestingly is both proof of racism, but also said that there's a bigger gap between their opinions and the opinions of the community, of the communities they will often speak for, than is acknowledged.
I've noticed there's a sort of segment of, I've noticed people on Twitter from the black community who are like huge Kamala Harris supporters. And like there's sort of this support of technocracy and neoliberalism from those people I've talked to on that end. But it's still really focused on racism at the same time.
Right. Well, I mean, racism is a real in some ways realer issue for them. Like, I don't want to belittle that. People sometimes think that that's just fake or a power grab. It's not. It's coming out of their quote-unquote lived experience. But lived experience, while valid, and a lot of leftists don't take it seriously enough, is still only one element in the matrix of how you understand things.
It's been very interesting for me because I've talked to people on both sides of this. And, you know, there will be – I'll talk to someone who came from a more – working class or lumpen background, and they may be white, and they'll say, well, this upper middle black person I know in college, how does racism affect them? And I'm like, well, class affects you, but you shouldn't like assume that racism doesn't affect someone from the upper middle if they're from the black community.
Right. In fact, it probably affects them more, frankly.
Right. Well, I don't see why. It's almost like this person I was talking to about it, they were saying, well, what about my experience as a working class person? Does that not matter because I'm white? And I said, no, I mean, class is an issue for you just as race is an issue for them. Both can be true at the same time.
Right. Well, I mean, this is why, like, traditionally we did encourage people to have solidarity amongst the class, and there is more solidarity amongst your own class, even amongst your own class of other races. And the working class is, in general, not trustful of politics. That's a thing, because both the left wing and the right wing has largely failed them in what's actually been possible in America, particularly if you're a person of color. All right. Particularly if you're a person of color, but not just if you're a person of color. So that's, you know, and all of it seems like the radical left has a hard time, like, seeing both things at once. The thing's got to be one way or the other. They can't look at the intersecting matrices, as you will. Now, I do admit there's a lot of baggage that comes with intersectional identitarianism that is problematic from my point of view, but I don't think the actual, you know, the legal framework it comes from is bad. I also don't think it's going to, like, produce reforms revolution. I don't think it was what it was designed to do. When Kimberly Crenshaw came up with that, it was designed to figure out a way to point out that sometimes there are intersections of things that make, you know, discriminative legal practices applicable. In specific, the instance they were talking about were like, where people couldn't get legal recourse because it wasn't just that they were a woman and it wasn't just that they were black that they were discriminated against. It's because they were in both categories. And that's, you know, that's where Crenshaw came up with her the basic of intersectional critical race theory in legal terms. Now, that's got a legal use and it's got a analytical use. It doesn't – I'm not so sure that we sometimes confuse things having a useful legal use and analytical use with a political use. But people also believe that everything is political, but they – by saying that, they often mean everything is the same thing, which is foolish. And I've said that for years. And, you know, I said that when I started Punk the Left in 2012, and I'll say it now. I think the personal might be political, but it doesn't mean that everything is the same. And also, politics is not always politics, if you know what I mean, as weird as that sounds. Like, we mean different things by that word at any given time, and yet we pretend like we don't. We deliberately conflate technical and common usages of these terms to avoid having to deal with it. It's a Montan Bailey problem, but yeah, it's a form of bad faith, but I also think it comes out of years and years and years of, like, not winning. And one of the things about the left and even the liberal left in America is it's won almost completely legal victories in the past 50 years, which means it's won almost completely defensive victories by which recourse to the law was used. Some of the law was invented interpretively and kind of whole cloth by legal rulings. And why are we surprised when through the political process we lose the ability to do that? Because we really should have been focusing on the political process, or even, you know, and from my point of view, revolutionizing and getting rid of a lot of the political process to do it. But let's even take the more moderate point of view for a second, by actually getting legislatures and changing legislature in. Now it seems to me like we focus on the executive to do that. And in America, that's even dumber than it is in the UK. And
it's very weird. I remember back in the Bush years, everyone would criticize Bush. I remember people like Greg Palast would, like, call him maximum leader, you know, as if, you know, like, basically saying, oh, he's a dictator. But that sort of, like, trust in the executive branch is almost, it's infected all sides of the political spectrum at this point.
Yeah, I'm going to use a Marxist term, but we're all Bonapartists now, whether we believe it or not. So we all think that an imperial executive can be used to our benefit. And what I've found interesting about Trump is not what he has been able to do, which is to make immigration much more inhumane, although it's in degree not kind. All those positions existed under Obama, and we have to be honest about that.
Do you think the conditions are any worse under Trump, though? That seems to be the argument.
I do think they are worse, but I also think the reasons why they are happening are different. So in the Obama period, it's in the first half of it, up to about 2013. Most of the people coming to the United States were economic, or they were male. asylum seekers, right? Now we're getting – now those drug wars in Central America have lasted long enough that we're getting people willing to risk their entire families. And this started before Trump. This started, you know, this caravan protesting with all these people getting out of, you know, Honduras and El Salvador started probably 2014, 2015 is when it really started heating up. And we had camps with kids in them even back in the Obama administration. But the number and amount is new. Part of that's probably – I mean, there's just a number of factors. People might blame climate change. People can definitely blame the drug war. There's geopolitical reasons. There's a thousand reasons why this is happening, but it's intensifying the kind of people coming to the border. Trump's treatment of this is more inhumane. I mean, he has made inhumane treatment of this a kind of deterrence tactic.
The thing that gets me is I kind of wonder what is Joe Biden going to do if he became president? I don't think he would reverse everything that Trump has done. I think no. This would be more of the same.
It would be softening, but it would still go. It would still probably keep on. Just like Trump didn't reverse what Obama was doing. You know, Obama, for whatever reason, only started to cut back ICE in the last year of his tenure as president. And his escalation of ICE was greater than Trump's. Now, Obama didn't have inhumanity as part, you know, like deliberately, you know, as a deterrent factor. So that's different. Another thing is extrajudicial killings. While that doctrine comes from George W. Bush, the president who first used it on a U.S. citizen was Obama. And then enshrine that for Trump. All that was done without congressional authorization, even though it technically risks war, which means that, you know, I'm proud the Democrats are reasserting that, but it does make it easier to call them hypocrites.
In reference to Obama, are you talking about I'm blanking on his name. Scott Horton used to talk about him all the time. The
cleric, the American-born cleric that he killed in a drone strike. Yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That established a precedent that Trump has accelerated. Trump is much more skittish about troops on the ground, mm-hmm. but has likely
probably should be.
Yeah, and he does seem to have some kind of distaste for like out and out American life risking war. But he has no problems accelerating the drone program. But the drone program was accelerated under Obama. He just talked about how he was the judicious hand guiding it. It was always seemingly based on the principle that, well, there will be a judicious hand guiding it. That was always stupid. Scott Horton and the libertarian anti-war movement back when there was an active such thing, they were right about that.
Well, I think this is a good segue. I guess we're going to talk about Iran after the events of last night. But it's interesting. I want to touch on this briefly. I mentioned Scott Horton. I think both of us sort of came from that libertarian, at times paleoconservative sort of end of the anti-war movement.
Yeah, we did.
I still think that both of us have like a remnant of their – the sort of view of war that sort of long gone movement now sort of had.
Right.
Does that make sense? Or
yeah, I mean, you know, I think that it colors my understanding of the anti-war movement. I find a lot of leftists to kind of, I mean, you know, you find diehard Leninists to call for critical revolutionary defeatism, which is where you hope when two imperial powers balance that yours loses. not that yours loses so much that your country is destroyed, but that yours loses its attempt to control another country. Right? That's what it meant. That's how Lenin actually took power in the Soviet Union. It's part of how the revolutions happened. Even more strategically, though, when you say that, it sounds like critical support for ISIS or something ridiculous, and has like it's so arcane that while it might be understandable to normal people, they're going to recoil from it, even if they agree with some of its underlying principles.
Do you think that's what drives maybe this idea that a lot of people say, well, all this stuff about Iran, it's all like the IEDs, that was a false flag, that never happened. Do you think that's what drives a lot of it? Like, oh, that doesn't look good.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of it. I mean,
because I mean,
and also there's a faux Cold War mentality. People seem to think that there's an ideological axis between China, Russia, and some other powers like Iran, Venezuela, whatever, that are somehow principledly anti-imperialist. And while you should never root for your own imperial power to win, you shouldn't lie to yourself about what these other players are. The protests in Iran right now are real. You know, I've talked to some Iranians in exile about them, and they're very real. And one of the benefits of the event last night is it's going to make it easier to crack down on those protesters, and also easier for the Supreme Leader to make an appeal to those protesters to support their nation against an imperialist threat. I mean, one of the funny things about this is people, and this is something that the anti-war libertarian movement that we were both kind of part of was actually better on, is sometimes both states benefit from a Cold War, even if it's objectively destructive and risk real war. Like I you know, for example, with Iran, people are like, blood for oil. You know, that wasn't even what happened in Iraq. Yes, some of the Iraqi oil fields were parceled out, but we don't need Iraqi oil. What they wanted actually was not more oil, but the ability to control futures in it, which is what actually sets oil prices. Like if we have too much oil, oil's just cheap and we burn through it too fast. People get that. That wasn't what was ever at stake. And I actually even think the oil vector wasn't the only vector in that war. There was this Clinton bombing of Iraq as a political distraction in the late 90s. There was our own wanting to erase our temporary support of them against Iran, and the proxy war that we used them for and gave them chemical weapons for, allowed them to use chemical weapons for by giving them strategic data on, despite our own rules against it. Which we use ironically to say that they had chemical weapons that we could never find. I mean, like that's the kind of stuff that we did and have used. But the idea that they just want to go in and occupy Iran, that's one, it would cause a world war. And I think Russia knows we don't.
Two, really I don't think the U.S. would fare well in an occupation. I think the U.S. has been losing the forever war for a long time.
Yeah, since Vietnam. Because forever wars don't have objectives. Like, if you look at Iraq, if your objective was just to overthrow the Ba'athist regime, we did do that. It wasn't hard. We have enough military power to do it very quickly. But to reestablish a stable society that doesn't produce, you know, other outlying effects and blowback, we cannot do that.
Well, it's interesting because I have a few leftist friends that will say, well, that's the point. It's not about winning the war. And I've always taken the more like view of like these occupations are eventually going to break the back of the U.S.
Well, yes. And well, here's what I think. Yeah. But I also think the U.S. isn't that stupid. You know,
that's what I've said about Iran, too. And people have like been confused. I don't think Iran is stupid either. That's what I don't know. Yeah.
Like, no, they would probably not lose, but it would still completely destroy the regime. All right. And the second, you know, they killed the general who has been strategically running, helping Assad in Syria, helping Hezbollah in Lebanon. I mean, like, there's like he was a strategic target, but he's also super popular, and he was the second, really kind of the second most powerful non-elected leader in Iran. What we are likely to see from this, though, is an escalation in Iraq. Now, this also there were protests in Iraq that people weren't following against both American and Iranian influence. But if people have to choose in Iraq between their neighbor and an even more foreign power, what are they going to choose? So in a way, this is kind of a strategic blunder, but it's also one that like you can see how people thinking there's a lead up to hot war, while I do think that's a real risk, all right? Because all it takes is one escalation of hostilities mistake But, you know, we would see Russia being far more bellicose if it was a real possibility.
Right, right.
Because they do not want Iran to fall.
Well, I guess the thing that I'm getting at, and this is aside from just what happened last night, this is more of a broader picture thing. But I notice both people on the right who think war is a fucking Rambo movie or a Rambo sequel.
Yeah.
And people on the left who just want to say...
blood, no blood for oil all the time, no matter
right,
what.
Right, right. Or, you know, the U.S. Empire. I mean, both of them seem to share this view that the U.S. is still this, like, hegemonic, the hyperpower.
Right, but when was the U.S. ever actually the hyperpower?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think that was always very illusory, and I think when we went into Iraq and Afghanistan, and you can disagree with me on this if you want, I think that was Bush showing our cards. I don't think anyone takes the U.S. seriously as a hyperpower.
No, I think they do, but not militarily. If we want to destroy you, what do we do? No, we don't. What do we do? How do we bring nations to their knees without having to lift a finger? Economic policy. Our military power is like the way we maintain economic power, but it in and of itself can't do much other than just it means that no one can attack our economic power. It does not mean that we can just go and occupy anywhere, and it never has. We have never been good at doing that without multinational support, which we generally don't have. When have we won an occupation other than against the native peoples, the indigenous peoples of North America? Like, you know, we didn't win the Philippines. We didn't win Vietnam. We didn't really win Korea. You know, we occupied Russia, but we had half of Europe on our side and the Soviet Union helping out.
We could argue about World War I and World War II. I remember there was a teacher I met at a university in California who said, it was odd because he was a neoconservative, but he said, if it wasn't for the French, we would have lost World War I. And if it wasn't for the Russians, we would have lost World War II. God bless them both.
I mean, I think it was sort of, I actually think that's true. And I have finally noticed that even in American jurisprudence, as much as we hate the Soviets, everyone's beginning to admit that World War II was impossible without them. I mean, if no other reason than the discipline in the Soviet army was as such that you could just cause them to go to run into the machine like Linux. Like, you know, like they didn't have to be efficient. And the cost to Russia was severe. I mean, like, you know, like, in some ways, Russia is just now recovering its male population from World War II. All right? Like, people should, like, think on that, actually, how severe that was. But my – you know, yeah, you're right. I also think, you know, people underestimate soft power. They also overestimate the power of Russia and China. China barely has a navy, does have a lot of defensive capacity, doesn't really have a kind of super trained up air force. I mean, it's not dealing in the raw power terms that we are, but we would not go to war with them. All right. The same is true with Russia. I mean, Russia actually, I find Russia most fascinating because Russia, like, other than its history of nukes and its geostrategic importance, shouldn't really be a major military power. Like, it's not economically productive enough. A lot of its equipment's been renewed, but it's still nothing like the United States. But if you were to have an out-and-out land war in Europe, they would definitely have an advantage, right? Because they have land access and we don't. You know, these basics of war are ignored. Like, the basics of class are ignored. I mean, like, people, I sometimes say knowing a little bit is worse than knowing nothing at all. And I think a lot of the way people talk about this is they know enough about the, you know, the shenanigans of Gulf War II. They know enough about Americans' dubious political history, or they know enough about, like, the heroic narratives I guess. I actually don't know where these Rambo notions come from, because outside of World War II, we don't have a single example of that in modern American history.
Well, I mean, even the response I've seen so far to this killing, this assassination in Iraq of this Iranian general, you know, just seeing some
people... A major Iraqi leader, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I've seen some people say, you know, oh, well... He deserved it because bad man. Which, okay, I mean, that's aside. To me, that's another discussion entirely.
Yeah, I mean, he was a very good general, which by definition probably makes him a bad man. But I mean, like, by most normal people's standards.
I have to be blunt. Like, I'm getting real tired of this mentality that I'm amazed that some people still have this mentality of. There are Americans that would say. Iran is not allowed to do anything. It's never allowed to retaliate, ever. It's not even allowed to defend its own interests. And I mean, like, I will get called, I've been called anti-American for saying, well, what do you expect Iran as a country to do? Should they, like, defend their interests when we've been breathing down their neck for years, sort of saber-rattling? I don't know what people expect Iran to do. Are they just supposed to lay down and you know, give up?
No, but then again, like, to me, the fundamental problem is thinking about this in terms of heroes and villains. Like, we just shouldn't think that way.
Well, yeah, yeah. Have you ever read Robert Fisk?
Yeah, a lot. You know, and he lost a lot of credibility with me for some of his naivete about the Egyptian Revolution, but I have read him, yes.
I love that, the book he wrote about Lebanon, where...
It's brilliant.
Yeah, there's a part in it where he says... War is not about heroes and villains. It's not about the victors. What war is about is about death and the infliction of death.
Right.
Like, he basically says all the other stuff is propaganda. It's a really traumatizing, horrible thing. It's the failure of civilization. And I think Robert Fisk nailed it there. You
But my problem with Fisk has always been actually a little bit that he doesn't listen to his own advice. Also, I think he doesn't see the things adjacent to war as being similar. You know, like the Egyptian Revolution, he did have a heroes and villains narrative about the Egyptian people and the Brotherhood that was naive, to put it at best. And I don't want to go over this, but for your listeners, I lived in Egypt during al-Sisi's, you know, rise to real power. Didn't talk about it when I lived there because it was dangerous. And I read Fisk's book on the Egyptian Revolution and what was going on and the revolution betrayed, and I agreed with some of what he said, but he just had a very naive view of the Brotherhood as an actual expression of popular will. And he also did, and thus he didn't read this as different factions at a low-key civil war with each other. He forgets that a revolution is a civil war first, even one that seems relatively bloodless, like the Arab Spring, or seemed relatively bloodless at the time. And so, I mean, it's been one of those things, JG, where, you know, this is more for me and you, but your audience may appreciate this. We have had to fall out of love with a lot of our early heroes, right?
That's very, very true.
And Robert Fisk was in mine. Cy Hurst is another, although I think Cy Hurst gets unduly discredited. The Intercept team, I used to have higher a theme for, you know, it's a thing.
We'll have to do a whole episode on Cy Hirsch at some point. I do think a lot of the criticisms unduly meted out to him.
Yeah, everybody causes like a slightly over hasty predictions on Iran too quickly. Because I'm like, well, if he was completely wrong, we wouldn't be sitting here right now. But yeah, I mean. But, you know, I mean, I've had, like, you know, Glenn Greenwald was one of my heroes, and I've had to really temper that in the last 5 years. You know, but we live in that time. I mean, And I, you know, we're talking real politics. I mean, one of the things right now is I think there's a whole lot of delusion on the left about how much influence we have. And also that a lot of what we're doing is even really properly speaking, like, meaningful politics.
Right, right. Well, it's like someone told me a while back that someone referred to someone said to me that ContraPoints, that she was doing politics with her videos. And I said, it's not politics.
No.
Like, she's doing social commentary, sure. She's thinking about things and critiquing things. But ultimately, I mean, and I would say this about my podcast as well, I don't think what we're doing is necessarily politics.
No, we might be doing political education, but that's not the same thing. This might be political in a broad, everything is political sense. But in a true sense of politics, politics requires either mass movements or power, one or the other, because one is the form of the other. Right? And when I say mass movements, I mean up to 33% of the population, usually with large swaths of certain social classes backing you. That is mass. Not even 100,000 people. Not even a mega protest. That is not really truly mass. Not a million man march. None of that.
Just a few more things real quickly here. Something I've been noticing is that everyone's saying that times are so different now, especially in terms of the political.
Because they're young and stupid.
That's well, I was going to say, I've noticed that there's like little pockets of the left that are now aligning with Alexander Dugin, and Dugin's influence is way overstated. I mean, he is a fascist, though. But I've said to people, I'm like, well, how is it much different? I mean, there's people trying to make an alliance with Dugin, just as back during the Bush years, there was, you know, paleocons and leftists working together hand in hand.
Yeah, and in the late aughts, early 2010s, there were this weird, like, hyper-reactionary support for North Korea. That was actually the largest group of North Koreans, as you say, support society. And I now hear all the leftists that support them go back to this time period and say that was just made up and propaganda. And that's just not true. I mean, and I have been bothered by the fact that, like, Stalinist, I'll use the term they prefer, Marxist-Leninist educational societies that are not even as radical as the old Maoists were. Like, they're just basically defending North Korea, Stalin, and like Deng as China as if they were the same thing. And those are becoming the most popular left podcasts, and I can't take that any more seriously than I take frog Nazis. I mean, I can't. And I know that'll get me in trouble, but like parlor Stalinism in a country where it doesn't really matter as a moral position that you take is not serious. Why is it not serious? Because you're not really putting your neck on the line, although it is an understandable reaction to trying to differentiate yourself from social democrats when the Trotskyists have fallen apart and when you're pushing back against a hostile society, which is why you see more of these emails, I think, in red states, actually, as opposed to like New York, which is calling with like social democrats, is they are pushing back against something and they're doing it radically. So I kind of give them credit for that, but it's a growing political movement, but it's not a serious one. And I find it remarkably historically unaware. And like one of my friends recently called El Chapo the Alex Jones of the left. And I was like, nah, man, that's Grover Fur. Like, that's all those, like, Stalin did nothing wrong conspiracy theories. You know, the secret speech. And the secret speech was cynical as fuck. I don't want to hide that from your audience. The Khrushchev secret speech was super cynical, and it was a way to, like, take light off the barbarity of the entire Soviet regime and try to place it on one man. And to make to distance yourself from the justification of necessity into principle under Stalinism into something else. I think that's super cynical and played into the West's hands and all that too. I actually agree with some of the anti-revisionists on that. But like, it doesn't mean that Khrushchev just lied. Like, it wasn't that simple. It wasn't manufactured out of nothing. And when you try to approach, you know, people, you know, with that, if people actually understand the history of things, even from a sympathetic, like, say Arthur Geddes, Sean Guillory perspective, it's not as condemning of the USSR. This tries to understand it. They're going to be like, what? You know, it's not a winning proposition for a variety of reasons. One is that in the actual history of Russia, it cost them 1/4 of their male population. A brain drain in decline that they had barely recovered from. Now, a good portion of that was World War II, but a lot of it was also the purges and the Soviet Cultural Revolution. And people don't even study the Soviet Cultural Revolution. So, you know, these things bug me because people speak about history as if they're an authority and they haven't really looked at it. And I realize there's lots that I can't know because, you know, I don't have a strong enough grasp of Russian. I don't really have much of any grasp of Russian. I realize that a lot of the 70s sources, even from left wingers, were biased and were working off of Cold War assumptions. I know all these things and they're big limitations, but it doesn't mean that just flipping that script is true. And that's really lazy. And, you know, even if you really believed in, like, Marxist-Leninism, you know, just uncritically parodying things from the Soviet Union from the 30s, how is that going to help you now? That would be like uncritically parodying things the Jacobins said in the French Revolution. Even if you supported the Jacobins, your social context is radically different. It's not as useful to you as you think.
You know, I was going to say, I think this circles back around to the last thing I wanted to touch upon, because it seems like in the left-wing media sphere, the big debate, or at least on social media, is this whole, I guess, class reductionism versus id poll sort of leftism and, you know,
yeah, unfortunately,
conservative leftism versus radical leftism. I don't even know anymore. There's so many sectarian feuds.
Who's a Strasserist and who isn't, even though no one seems to know what Strasserism is. It's not just, you know, nationalist leftism, guys. Let's be frank for a second. I think the whole thing is kind of misguided. Right. You have talked to people who were supposedly on both sides of the debate. Like, some people call me a class reductionist, even though, you know, and I told you in a podcast we never released that my first concerns, because they were pressing in my life, were actually anti-racist ones. It was only in college when I got when I moved up a social class that I had enough perspective on my own social class to be mad about it. You know, and
well, I mean, isn't your basic view that let's say there was a class revolution? I don't think that would necessarily, from your perspective, mean that all the issues of race are going to go away tomorrow.
No, I don't think so. I actually think it would help us understand what the issues of race actually are. And there are also the other things. Is the issues of race vary from group to group? Like, for example, if you buy into the Black Belt thesis and also buy into indigenous land rights, how do you square that circle? Like, if you're a desettler, right? Well, you have to admit that, like, the African diaspora and the indigenous interest are only the same when white people are in charge. When they are no longer in charge, they're actually not the same. And I don't see anyone really dealing with that. Although I do know indigenous activists who will talk about that privately. And I do know Black activists who talk about that, you know, the whole, what's it, Blue Cap movement or whatever, the black anti-immigrant movement, who also thinks that stuff for the amelioration of slavery shouldn't go to blacks in general, but to the descendants of slaves in particular, and you'd have to prove it. There are breakdowns within these sort of micro-nationalisms or demographic identitarian movements that aren't addressed by the ID poll framework. But also, I agree with you that a class revolution won't magically fix it all. Our social classes...
I know everyone, rags on sociology, but, I don't think even a revolution changes every single social structure overnight. You need institutions to change all the social structures.
Well, I'm not even... I actually will go even farther than you. I think superstructure needs to change. That's even more than institutions. Right, that requires time.
Right. I would agree with that as well.
And we've seen a lot of that. Capitalism has changed a lot of it on its own. It's just not been as liberatory as people thought. There was a huge movement for just more inclusion over capital, because being excluded for it meant you were basically surplus population and starved after you weren't chattel used to build it up. Now we have debates over the real meaning of the Civil War, as if it couldn't mean more than one thing and stuff like that. These notions of history are just way too simple. So I agree with you. And from my perspective, also, gender and race don't really marry each other. Gender and sex competition exists in all societies so far, and we've been trying to work through that. They're different, and there are some that are way more egalitarian than others, but I can't think of one without some kind of division of labor that's gendered. And we're trying to move past that. We have that tension going in every text, every society that we have written literature from.
I can't even do the whole gender debate anymore, to be honest.
I think actually that how messy it is a good sign, believe it or not, because it's a sign that we are trying to figure out a better way to frame all this. And we don't really have one yet. So a lot of our frameworks are contradictory. And this used to really bug me. How can you be both non-binary and truly believe in transness, right? Because non-binariness implies that there is no trans. And you see this in the fights with ContraPoints, frankly, right? And what side do you pick on that? And I just think we're going to look back in this time period and see, we were struggling for a new way to frame this, because in some ways, finally, we had the material means to get beyond some of our gender problems. We now understand hormones and can do surgeries to change this. All right. But before we had the technology to do that, it really was not changeable. You could change your social structures, but the fact that women could get pregnant and men couldn't wasn't going to change. Now it can. So that changes the game, and we're dealing with that. And so I have a lot of compassion for people going through this gender reassessment. But I also think we are going to look back and feel like, we didn't really know what we were doing yet. I think, kind of like...
I guess it's because of the areas of the country I'm in. I usually split a lot of time between Florida and Pennsylvania. But a lot of... just the way... The sort of conservative way of thinking about gender just sort of, it's I think it's getting more extreme in a lot of ways.
It is. But one thing I will say, and I don't think they're equivalent. I obviously think that one of the weird things about non-binary gender means that I've heard things even on left-wing stuff referred to as gendered in ways that I didn't used to hear.
What I find weird is that now there's not even a mentality amongst the more right-wing folks I know of saying, you can bridge differences between genders. Now it's there's people I know that are in college that are just men going their own way and fucking crazy. I don't understand.
Yeah, you have the men's right versions of lesbian separatists, except they're also anti-gay. Right. So, but also, I don't understand it. But if they actually take them so seriously, they won't be a problem for more than a generation.
That's actually very true.
You know, they'd be like the Shakers. There'll be a few of them, but whatever. But no, I mean, the one thing about large populations of highly alienated males is, historically speaking, that's highly socially destabilizing. And we're not the only society dealing with it either.
It's interesting, too, because this gets into, like, I'm just so fed up. I think we're both fed up with, like, the culture wars.
Yeah, culture wars are stupid.
I think we talk to people from, like, many different walks of life. I mean, I'll talk to the cosmopolitan West Coast people, and then I'll talk to people from, like, a rural area, and I will find massive fault with both, especially when they start, like, attacking each other as, like, demonic forces.
Yeah, well, they don't know each other.
Right.
What's funny to me is how similar a lot of them are. You know, I mean, I don't want to say we're all the same, we're not, but, like...
I think we have more in common than we realize as a species.
Right. But I also think, like, a lot of people misunderstand things. Like, why is there so much hostility? Like, yes, more poor people support Democrats and Republicans. True. Completely true. But the fact that the largest blue state is California, even though that's kind of deceptive, too, because the Republican areas in California are scary. I'm not going to lie. You know, you go out into... Much past the Modesto Valley in Northern California, and, you know, it almost seems like a caricature. But California is, like, one of the reasons why I think conservatives have, you know, conservatives can easily throw the charge of elites at, like, liberals, is while, for example, progressive liberals have more support amongst the poor, truly, they also have more support in the areas that are the most affluent on the United States and some of the most affluent on Earth. You know, like, California has economic problems because it's so abundant and cannot figure out a way to price for it. And thus sends its middle class to other states and also has the largest, you know, homeless population in the country by orders of magnitude. Let's go ahead. The California stuff is just...
Too much.
Yeah. I mean, it's a rant, but it's one of those things where, like, everybody's kind of wrong. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you can demonize, you know, the fact that the blue states are richer. There are also plenty of Republicans in those areas, and they tend to be richer even then. It's the whole thing is people distort their understanding of demographics and avoid, and they really kind of avoid looking at class anyway. So even the class reductionists kind of avoid actually looking at class. Like, they seem to mean something cultural, right? Like, I was born in the working class, not necessarily what I do for my day job.
Well, I think we'll have to continue this conversation on a future edition of the program.
Yep.
See Derek Farn of Zero Books and the new and improved Pop the Left podcast. Thank you for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with C. Derek Varn, and consider checking out his new podcast, Pop the Left, over at Zero Books. Let me know what you thought of this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. For my Patreon supporters, I should be recording a new edition of the Parallax Views Current Events program the week that was fairly soon, and I will be adding archived editions of early Parallax Views programs to the Patreon feed. Your support is very much appreciated, especially in the new year. Thank you so much if you have been supporting Parallax Views on Patreon. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.